From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A busy news day Thursday with former FBI Director James Comey testifying about Trump and Russian interference in the 2016 election, as well as his own firing. Also, a surprise outcome in the UK elections. For more on that, we spoke with noted historian, author, and educator, Dr. Gerald Horn. Well, Dr. Horn, the world is abuzz with the testimony of James Comey and the tweets of Donald Trump and everything in between. And all of this takes place in the context of a surprising election in the UK and lots of other things, too, including the attack in Tehran the other day.
Well, let's start with Comey. The testimony yesterday before a Senate panel of sacked FBI Director James Comey, sacked by President Donald J. Trump some weeks ago. The question on the table immediately is, was there a criminal offense committed in the midst of all of these events? That is to say, was there an obstruction of justice, which of course tripped up both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton? It's a difficult question to answer. Certainly there is the requisite corrupt intent on the part of Mr. Trump in terms of his words and his deeds in terms of the sacking of Mr. Comey. However, today's Justice Department has taken the position that there can be no indictment of a sitting U.S. president. And in any case, former Harvard Law School professor Alan Dershowitz, a pro-Israel stalwart, and also, interestingly enough, a champion of Mr. Trump, at least on the cable chat shows, has put forth this idea of the so-called unitary executive, which suggests that a president or this president can sack whoever he wants who serves at the pleasure of a president or this president. Secondly, is impeachment on the table? You may recall that some days ago, Congressman Al Green of Houston talked about impeachment on the floor of the House. He, of course, was then bombarded with racist attacks. And this leads me to what is probably the relevant point, which is that the Donald J. Trump base does not seem to be fragmenting in the light of all of this surmounting evidence, this mountainous evidence, I should say, about Mr. Trump's misdeeds. In fact, the GOP congressional members seem to be more concerned about facing a primary challenge in 2018 rather than bringing Mr. Trump to justice. You should also know that Martin Wolf of the Financial Times has suggested just a day or two ago that even with the budget cuts, which are targeting Mr. Trump's base, he would be surprised if that even led to a fragmenting of the Trump base. And in that regard, Business Week has suggested that the cuts Mr. Trump has slated for Social Security disability insurance will hit particularly the Trump base in Southern Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia, literally throwing many of them onto the streets. But if Martin Wolf of the Financial Times is to be believed, that will not necessarily lead this base to a turn to the left. And if that is so, obviously we have a lot of analyzing to do in these United States of America. Now, of course, a bipartisan consensus emerged in Washington that Russia was seeming to subvert the U.S. electoral process. Now, let's set aside for a moment what we all know, which is the United States is a past master at subverting electoral processes, not only in Haiti and in Chile, where they helped to overthrow Salvador Allende in 1973, but even in Moscow itself, when former Russian President Boris Yeltsin was shelling his own parliament to the cheers from Washington, and then helped to then was aided by Washington in getting reelected in the face of that tragedy, that treacherous act on his part. But set that aside for the moment. Look at the January 2017 report, supposedly a consensus by 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, although I tend to doubt if the U.S. Coast Guard Intelligence Agency had too much to contribute with regard to Russia. In any case, if you look at that report, it's a very flimsy report. It even digs up episodes from RT, the Moscow-based TV network from 2012, which supposedly speaks to what happened in 2016, which barely passes the giggle test. And in any case, if you look at this Russia obsession right now, which is gripping Washington, it is claimed an early victim in the form of reality Lee Winter, the 20-something U.S. intelligence agency contractor, now jailed for supposedly leaking to The Intercept, a internet news journal, a report from the National Security Agency supposedly detailing Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. election. It's a very curious episode, I have to say. First of all, with regard to The Intercept, which, as you know, has been led by and features Glenn Greenwald of Edward Snowden fame, not to mention Jeremy Scahill, a frequent contributor to Pacifica News. If you accept the press reports with regard to how reality Lee Winter wound up in jail, there seems to have been an incredible botch on the part of The Intercept in terms of supposedly turning over this copied document to the NSA, and they were able to then track down Ms. Winter as a result. I find that hard to believe. I mean, I think, at least I had thought these people were more professional and skilled than that, but that's what the press is telling us. In any case, even as the New York Times concedes, country A can hack country B and make it seem like country C was actually the perpetrator. In fact, if you look at the New York Times this morning with regard to what's happening in the Persian Gulf, with regard to the Gulf kingdom that is Qatar, it seems that what led to this crisis, which has led to an Arab Sea and land embargo on Qatar, and quite frankly is a very dangerous crisis, is a hacking of Qatar. Who knows who did this hacking? It could have been Saudi Arabia, in fact, which would have provided them with a pretext from which they could pressure Qatar in order to get it to renounce its close ties to Iran. But back to this Russia obsession, another victim, it seems to me, ironically enough, of this obsession with Moscow may be the 80-year-old senior senator from Arizona, John McCain. I hope, or perhaps I do not hope, that you were able to witness his questioning of James Comey. He seemed to be suggesting that Senator Clinton was in league with Moscow to hack her campaign, and it really made no sense. It made you think that this senator, who has claimed most recently that Russia is a bigger threat to the United States than ISIS, that he may be losing his marbles, which is quite dangerous given his impact on U.S. foreign policy.
You know, one of the,
it reminds me of Secretary of the Pentagon James Forrestal some decades ago, who had Russia on the brain to such a degree that he actually committed suicide because he thought the Russians were after him. In any case, what this rather unsavory episode helps to reveal is that there's a serious split within the U.S. ruling elite with regard to Russia. I would urge the U.S. ruling class to perhaps calm their rhetoric, because if you look at the international situation, because of Donald Trump's mishaps, the international situation is turning in a way that is not necessarily friendly to the United States of America. I'm not only speaking of what Chancellor Merkel said just a few days ago about how Europe has to take its destiny into its own hands after her confrontation with Donald Trump in Italy at the G7 summit. I'm not only talking about the fact that despite U.S. press reporting that was quite one-sided, newly installed French President Macron invited Vladimir Putin to Versailles. Of course, all the coverage on this side of the Atlantic was supposedly about how he was dressing down Putin about human rights and RT and Sputnik News. But actually, the story there is that I think that with the alienation, the growing alienation between Washington and the North Atlantic bloc, that the North Atlantic countries, particularly Germany and France, and the European Union will probably have to lessen sanctions against Moscow, which, of course, is already being championed by the third largest EU nation, which is Italy. In any case, back to this Persian Gulf crisis, once again, it's striking to note that Qatar, which has made a small fortune, actually a large fortune, from natural gas exports, now sees those exports to Europe constrained because of the air, sea, and land embargo, which once again benefits Gazprom to the cheers of Moscow. And even if you look at the Venezuela crisis, one of the many reasons why the Maduro government has not been shaken from power, it's because of the developing close ties between the energy complex in Venezuela and the energy complex in Russia. So this rather one-sided attack on Russia, led from Washington, has the potential to backfire. If the U.S. ruling elite is listening to this broadcast, I would urge them that with regard to the Donald J. Trump scandal, that they follow the money. What I mean is that already there is on the record evidence of very suspicious financial dealings between Russian oligarchs and Mr. Trump, not least with regard to the selling of condos and Trump properties, not least with regard to a almost 100% profit that Mr. Trump made on the selling of a property in Southern Florida. That bears the odor of some kind of under the table contribution to Mr. Trump personally or to his campaign. And in any case, with regard to the Democrats, I think that they'll gain more traction with regard to following the money. And I would also say that the scandal of the November 2016 election was not necessarily Russian hacking, which neither the Democrats or the Republicans suggest actually involved tampering with the ballot box directly, but the question of voter suppression, the question particularly of the Republican Party's continuing crusade to repress particularly the black vote, but particularly the vote of any who would vote against the GOP. But as of now, it does not look like the ruling class nor the Democratic Party will be taking my advice.
Well, on the last question of voter suppression, of course, aside from the almost institutional character of it in American elections, opening it up for 2016, of course, would likely provoke an opening up of voter suppression in things like the Democratic primary in New York, which some 300,000 people found themselves disenfranchised. And there were complaints of that around the country. But certainly what's been happening to black voters, particularly for decades, or, well, going back to the Constitution, really, but where it's been termed voter suppression, we can go back at least to the 2000 election and look at that. And there hasn't really been any stomach for addressing that in Congress or in the institutions at the state level either. Rather, the contrary.
I'm afraid that you are correct. Now, fortunately, there have been a few recent Supreme Court decisions, particularly with regard to that question in the state of North Carolina, where the courts have suggested that districts were drawn and measures were taken with, quote, surgical precision, unquote, designed to target and suppress the vote of the African-American electorate in particular. It's striking to note that in one of the most recent decisions, the Supreme Court, in the decision authored by Justice Kagan, an Obama appointee, got a majority where she suggested that the North Carolina legislature was trying to gerrymander the black population, that is to say, to create districts whereby the black vote could not be as robust as it ordinarily would. And what would be, and interestingly enough, Clarence Thomas, the most conservative member of the high court, who happens to be black, as you know, actually joined in that opinion. And we'll have to examine very carefully why that is the case. But I don't think going forward that you can necessarily expect any kind of progressive sentiment emerging from the court, not only because of the recent appointment of Neil Gorsuch, the right-wing crusader to the high court, replacing Antonin Scalia, one of the few victories that Mr. Trump can claim, but also on the fast track to appointment or scores of federal court justices, judges by Mr. Trump, who will be shaping the U.S. law for decades to come. This brings into high relief, it seems to me, the recent decision by the NAACP board to sack its leader, Cornell Brooks, who they suggested was unable to keep pace with the gathering anti-Trump resistance. But I think that this is too much to lay at the doorstep of Mr. Brooks. I think that the problem with the NAACP starts at the top, not necessarily Mr. Brooks, but with the board that sacked Mr. Brooks. That's to say, decades ago, the NAACP made a Faustian bargain with the U.S. ruling elite to sack its founder, W.E.B. Du Bois, who had returned to the organization in 1944, sacked in 1948 because of his left-wing sentiments. That led to a purge of the left from the NAACP, particularly radicals, particularly communists. Then in the 1960s, with the rise of black nationalism, the NAACP, under the leadership of Roy Wilkins, was in the forefront of castigating and denouncing the sentiment represented by Malcolm X. What's striking is that Cornell Brooks was sacked by the NAACP board on May 19th, 2017, which happens to be Malcolm X's birthday. The irony there is really too much to digest, quite frankly, but it does seem to me to point to a potential remedy for the NAACP, which is retracing its steps, apologizing to the ideological descendants of W.E.B. Du Bois and of Malcolm X, and welcoming both back into the ranks. And that will lead, it seems to me, to an energized anti-Trump base, anti-Trump resistance base within the NAACP itself. Until that happens, it seems to me that voter suppression by the Republican right will continue to gain traction.
Okay, so let's back out of this a little bit and talk about the the question of Russian interference, I guess, is the more generic term that they use instead of hacking in the election. The document, to the extent there has been any documentation released to the public that we've seen that you referenced earlier, the extent of the evidence presented really is a series of 2012, excerpts of RT reports and other things as weighty as that. This came out with a popular, the announcement of Russian interference back in 2016 was a broad salvo throughout the media that's really still echoing very loudly. And it was Russian hacking of the election. And the original hacks were supposedly the emails and the materials from the DNC and Clinton that were released to the public. And then there were actual allegations, including filed by Jill Stein in Wisconsin originally, that there was some foreign interference in the actual vote counting process. When they talk now about hacking, no one seriously mentions that, although recently that got some lift again from the piece that was published by Greenwald's website. But let's look at the actual basis here. You mentioned the fact the U.S. has a very long history. We could spend the next 4 hours just listing items of U.S. interference in the governing of other nations. But the actual influence of the Russians could be distilled down, I guess, to Russian media outlets that are consumed here in the U.S., particularly RT and Sputnik, and whatever diplomatic moves they have made that sort of are, coordinate with some sort of a narrative that was being sold through their media outlets. With the reach of RT and Sputnik in the United States is impressive for what they are, but negligible compared to New York Times, CNN, etc. And so the case really for Russia being, having influenced the outcome of the election is pretty weak as presented thus far. Yet, and you point out again, and it's been pointed out, that if Trump is been or has been engaged in obstruction of justice, it's not necessary that the underlying case has any validity. It's the actions that would be committed by him and the requisite criminal intent. Given the massive amount of government and political and media resources that have been devoted to this narrative and to this alleged case that we've yet to see, how do you balance the fact that at the end of the day it should be Trump that's pushed out of office rather than some accountability for the balance of this drama?
Well, with regard to Trump being pushed out of office, it's difficult to see, even if there's an earthquake in the 2018 elections with Republicans losing their majorities in both the House and the Senate, it's difficult to see a U.S. Senate voting by two-thirds vote to actually remove Trump from office after a House impeaches him. And I say that because if you look at some of these Democrats, like Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, I mean, he votes oftentimes with Republicans, and he often takes a Republican line. And it doesn't seem that kind of approach by many Democrats will be changing even if there is an earthquake in the 2018 congressional elections and midterm elections. Second of all, with regard to Donald J. Trump, it seems to me that from the point of view of the U.S. ruling elite, it made a certain kind of sense to try to lessen tensions with Moscow, given the fact that China is in the passing lane. I just finished reading the book by Graham Allison of the Kennedy School at Harvard, Destined for War, which is about, of course, the U.S.-China relationship. And he quotes statistics that many quote with regard to how, by some measures, the Chinese economy is already larger than the U.S. economy, how the U.S. government is dependent upon the People's Bank in Beijing buying U.S. Treasury bills, which means that the United States is basically dependent on the kindness of strangers. There's all sorts of evidence to suggest that just as Richard M. Nixon, four decades ago, was able to co-opt Beijing into an anti-Soviet front, and arguably that was a factor in leading to the collapse of the Soviet Union on December 25th, 1991, that did not lead to eternal U.S. hegemony, which was what was thought at the time. In fact, the United States basically had to build up China to a certain degree in order to bring down the Soviet Union. And now it seemed as if the worm should turn and that a Trump administration should now try to co-opt Moscow against Beijing. Now, it seemed to me that was always going to be a very difficult proposition. One, because of the encrusted, inured Russophobia that exists in the United States as a result of decades of Cold War, not to mention the fact that we're marking the centennial of the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution and the kind of hysteria that helped to generate. And secondly, so much of the U.S. ruling elite is invested so heavily in China. That is to say, if you look at the U.S. corporations, be it Apple or Microsoft or General Motors or KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, they're all making small fortunes in China. And I add Starbucks to that list as well. So,
and not so small.
Why would they? Sorry?
And not so small in some cases.
Exactly. So why would they want to destabilize their significant markets? So it was always going to be a difficult proposition. And that leads me to the third point, which is that more than 130 years ago, a U.S. robber baron suggested that he could buy off one half of the U.S. working class to fight the other half. And that has been part of the key to the so-called stability of the United States of America in recent decades. It seems that what's happened now is that countries like China have decided that they can buy off maybe not one half of the U.S. ruling elite, but certainly a significant percentage, and that basically stays the hand of the White House when it seeks to try to destabilize China so far. Now, of course, I had thought in December 2016, when Trump had reached out to the president of Taiwan, the rebel province that China claims as its own, that he was basically saying to Apple and Microsoft and GM and Starbucks and KFC that you're going to have to take a haircut, that the United States is going to have to move aggressively against China, and your investments are going to be in jeopardy. I think that that helped to engender a real scare in the U.S. ruling elite, which helps to account for some of the difficulties that Mr. Trump has had. With regard to that, let me add a major footnote, which is the Washington Post, which has been in the vanguard of negative Trump reporting. It's been bought, as you know, by Jeff Bezos, who was on track to supplant Bill Gates as the planet's richest man. Jeff Bezos, of course, is a controlling shareholder in Amazon. During the 2016 campaign, Mr. Trump suggested, and once again, even a stop clock is right twice a day, Mr. Trump suggested, it seems to me, with some credibility, that an antitrust lawsuit should be brought against Amazon because of its monopolistic tendencies. Amazon right now is creating a nuclear winter for the U.S. retail sector. I mean, look at Sears Roebuck today. I mean, don't invest. Here's a stock tip. Don't invest in Best Buy.
Not only that, don't invest in the various real estate investment trusts that own the malls that these retail spaces occupy. They've been in a catastrophe since 2007, 2008.
Right, exactly. And you can lay a good deal of this at the doorstep of Amazon. And by the way, it's also shellacking Walmart, which in many ways is the People's Republic of China on this side of the Pacific.
Right.
Now, it seems to me that we would be naive to think that the anti-Trump reporting in the Washington Post is not shaped in some measure by the fact that Jeff Bezos thought that his company was going to come under attack by the Trump administration, and I might say perhaps quite correctly by the Trump administration. Mm. This leads me to suggest that progressive forces in the United States obviously need a deeper analysis of what's going on in this country, because events are happening with hypersonic speed, and it's problematic. It seems to be difficult for our side to keep up with the import of these events, which of course brings me to the British election, where Theresa May was handed her hat by the British electorate. She had called a snap election in mid-April, thinking that she could add to her majority. Actually, she lost her majority. It's a hung parliament. The Labour Party, which had been given up for dead, particularly by the mainstream media under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, who actually is to the left of Bernie Sanders, which, of course, has a lot to do with the fact the United States is the right-wing outlier, which is my point, which is that with Brexit in June 2016, we were told that there was this right-wing populist surge in the North Atlantic nations, which seemingly reached a zenith and an apex with the election of Donald J. Trump on November 8, 2016. But you've had setbacks to the neo-fascists in France in the French elections some days ago, setbacks to the neo-fascists in Holland and in Austria. The British elections also meant a setback for the Scottish nationalists. They lost seats, which probably stays their hand in terms of pulling out of the UK altogether, which was being threatened. And part of the good news, too, of the British elections is the UK Independence Party, which had helped to engineer Brexit in the first place, has basically dissolved, which is great news. It was really the right-wing populist hope in Britain. And in fact, Nigel Farage, who is one of Trump's closest comrades in Britain, is now supposedly under investigation by the U.S. federal authorities for certain misdeeds. So that is something to celebrate.
Dr. Horn, thank you very much. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.